Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Department of English, the Center for the Study of Europe, the American and New England Studies Program, the Women's, Gender, and Sexuality Studies Program, and the Department of World Languages and Literatures. Our speaker is Sharon Marcus, Associate Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. Professor Marcus's lecture is titled The Drama of Celebrity. Tonight's moderator, Boston University Associate Professor of English, Joseph Rezik, begins his introduction with a description of Marcus's 2007 work, Between Women, Friendship, Desire, and Marriage in Victorian England.
Between Women accounted for the wide array of relationships that women held with each other in Victorian England, from friendship to sexual desire. One surprise, and there were many of Marcus's account, was that they held these relationships openly, even relationships that we might call deviant, and not in secret. Marcus asked historians, literary scholars, feminists, and queer theorists to reconsider the evidence about relationships between women in the 19th century in novels, poetry, magazines, diaries, letters, and elsewhere, not for what such evidence seemed to be hiding, but for what, on the surface, it revealed. Subsequent to her reexamination of the overt meaning of evidence, Marcus co-authored an influential essay, as I'm sure many of you know, with Stephen Best, which was published in Representations in 2009, Surface Reading, An Introduction. This essay offered a critique of the state of symptomatic reading, close reading, and the hermeneutics of suspicion as they then were practiced in the field of literary studies, arguing for a method that attended to the surfaces of texts, rather than their supposedly obscured, unacknowledged, or hidden depths. People interested in what can now fairly be called the history of surface reading, the essay appeared a decade ago, should consider not only the many passionate responses to Marcus and Best, but also the theory's important origins in Marcus's meticulous cultural history of female friendship and desire. Marcus's broader contribution to the humanities is best represented by Public Books, a journal that she edits and co-founded in 2012, which publishes online searching and accessible essays and reviews by academics, activists, and intellectuals. Public Books models the best practices in what is now referred to commonly as the public humanities, a movement that aims to disseminate the work of professional scholars to a large general readership, to provoke, share, and encourage. We need to learn to communicate to the public, as well as to ourselves, to show them that the humanities is thriving like never before. Sharon's talk tonight will no doubt vindicate that claim. Please join me with a warm welcome.
To get this started, I will
just hit that.
Thank you very much, Joe, for that very generous, somewhat difficult to live up to introduction. Thanks to everyone who helped to sponsor this, and thank you all for being here. I'm going to begin just by letting you know that in the course of this talk, I will be showing imagery and quoting language that is racist, and I will then be analyzing it. And I'm only doing that to the extent that I think it's necessary for making clear the phenomenon that I am discussing. This talk is drawn from a book entitled The Drama of Celebrity, and it's drawn from a chapter called Imitation. Let me start by giving you a very brief overview of the book's argument. What I'm trying to do in this book is offer a new history of celebrity culture that will also produce a new theory of celebrity culture, new relative to the most common and commonly cited extant theories, which tend to explain celebrity culture by pointing to a single cause, the media or the culture industry or the activities of fans. Rarely in academic discourse does anyone see celebrities themselves as having a causal or anything other than an arbitrary relationship to celebrity culture. But certainly celebrity biography goes in the absolute other direction and tends to see celebrity culture as the result of what celebrities themselves do. The majority of the most widely cited academic theories by Leo Brody, Richard Dyer, Joshua Gamson, and David Marshall ultimately posit celebrity culture as a form of domination or delusion to be resisted. These theories see celebrity culture as a binary zero-sum game that pits the dupes against the duped or sets resisting knowing fans tilting against powerful monoliths. By contrast, I argue throughout the book that celebrity culture is a triangular game involving three equally powerful groups: publics, media workers, and celebrities themselves, All three of those entities, publics, media, workers, and celebrities themselves, compete and collude in an endless game to assign value and meaning to renowned individuals. And it is never given in advance which group will win a given match. One of the key examples that theorists have offered to provide evidence of the stupidity of publics enthralled to celebrity culture is the phenomenon of fans imitating their favorite icons. From the most dedicated Elvis impersonators to sports fans casually wearing sneakers endorsed by famous athletes, ordinary men and women have for many decades enjoyed imitating famous ones. In the 1910s, women bobbed their hair to look like dancer Irene Castles. In 1964, the Life magazine article pictured here reported that British boys were paying $1.85 for a Beatles haircut and that 20,000 Beatles wigs had been sold. The article went on to report that one public schoolboy threatened with expulsion if he adopted a bowl cut, chose expulsion. Whether reproducing Farrah Fawcett's feathered flip in the 1970s or failing to, donning black rubber bracelets and lace gloves a la Madonna in the early 1990s, or posting photos in the 2010s on a site dedicated to lesbians who resemble Justin Bieber, the relatively unknown have long patterned themselves on the well-known. Now, it's easy to view those who copy celebrities as having surrendered their freedom and individuality, their agency, to the hypnotic effects of mass culture. Theodore Adorno, never one to take the rosy view, argued that even the most spontaneous seeming reactions to mass culture, such as in the example I'm about to quote, dancing to jazz music, only imitate the gestures associated with true pleasure. Commenting on the results of what he called mimesis, Adorno wrote, quote, "The behavior of the victims recalls St. Vitus's dance or the motor reflex spasms of the maimed animal," end quote. What Adorno considered forcibly produced imitations, that's his word, forcibly, looked to him more like injury, disease, or death than like genuine self-expression and individuality. And that, too, is his phrase. So on the one hand, imitation, mimesis. On the other hand, real self-expression and individuality. So for Adorno, the imitation is always coerced. Others have argued that celebrity imitation can serve more useful and happy purposes in constructing a sense of self. Indeed, many social theorists would argue that mimesis and imitation is the basis of culture and cultural transmission. But specifically in the realm of star and celebrity studies, in the early 1990s, film scholar Jackie Stacey's pioneering work challenged the characterization of female film spectators as passive by eliciting British women's memories of viewing Hollywood films in the 1940s and 1950s. Stacey argued that ordinary women saw female stars as representing a glamour and abundance that offered a temporary respite from wartime austerity. She articulated that identification did not always express itself as imitation. In fact, for many of the women, the gap between themselves and their favorite stars was a source of pleasure. But Stacey quotes many instances when identification did lead to imitation. The women she surveyed in 1989 recalled 40 years earlier, copying hats, shoes, hairstyles, and eyebrows seen in films, brushing their hair to look like Betty Davis's in Dark Victory, buying a suit after seeing Marilyn Monroe wear one in Niagara, or wearing boleros because Deanna Durbin favored them. And all of this is behavior that we could all observe happening even as we speak, perhaps even as we sit here. Sociologists studying responses to Princess Diana's death in 1997 found that many people explicitly turned to celebrity biography to glean solutions to common problems. Others have found that blockbuster Hollywood stars model ways to express positive emotions, while indie stars provide templates for voicing skepticism, alienation, and defiance. Post-game interviews with athletes similarly illustrate how to voice winning and losing, satisfaction and disappointment. Like the deportment and elocution manuals so popular before the rise of radio and television, media coverage of celebrities offers the general public guidelines for how to be in the world. Now, these two positions, the Adorno position, the Stacey position, assign very different values to imitation, but both assume that copying comes easily. Adorno considered imitation an unavoidable reflex, nothing easier than that, and many write of popular culture is exerting an irresistible force that makes it impossible not to mimic it. Even scholarship that emphasizes the agency of fans, like Stacey's, tends to assume that anyone who wants to imitate a celebrity is free to do so without encountering obstacles or attracting censure. What, however, if celebrity imitation is not automatic and effortless, but a choice and a skill? And what if, far from being open to all or imposed on ordinary people as a way to keep them down, celebrity imitation is a privilege that members of dominant groups often seek to deny to those insubordinate ones? An anecdote about the novelist Henry James illustrates just how deliberate, difficult, and exclusionary celebrity imitation can be. Given his high standards and elevated style, James may seem an unlikely candidate for fanboy, but he began his career in the 1870s as a theater reviewer and continued for many decades to publish essays about playwrights and actors, and he was particularly sensitive to and appreciative of good actors. Despite his interest in drama and performance, James is also known for having strongly criticized modern celebrity culture in works such as The Aspern Papers and The Death of a Lion, which showcase the dangers of paying more attention to the private lives of artists than to their work. As a drama critic covering the Paris theater scene in the 1870s, James had singled out French actress Sarah Bernhardt, pictured here, for praise early in her career. And Bernhardt is the through line of my book. She'll be returning throughout this talk, so I'll just very briefly give you an overview of her career. She's born, well, there are many suggestions about what year she was born, but the one that scholars tend to converge around is 1844. She died in 1923. She was acting almost until her death. From the mid-1860s through 1879, she acquired increasing fame in the Paris theater scene, and this was at a time when Paris was the theater capital of the world. And then in 1879, she went to London and had a huge hit there, then toured Europe. She left the French National Theater to become an independent performer. She then toured the United States, and throughout her career, she conducted about 9 international tours, many of them lasting up to a year. And on those tours, she wouldn't just go to major capital cities. She'd go to tiny towns in Oklahoma and things that weren't even states yet in the United States. So she was a very global star, and she wasn't unique in this. Many celebrities in the 19th century were global celebrities. So James was one of the first to write in the United States for The Nation, which is what he reviewed drama for, about what a great actress Bernhardt was. But in 1879, after she rocketed to international stardom in London, he cuttingly rebuked her for becoming, quote, a celebrity pure and simple, thanks to what he called her advertising genius. So anticipating in some ways the Adorno-type critique of celebrity as bound up in commodity culture. But much as James disapproved of Bernhardt's celebrity-seeking ways, he continued to admire her acting, as we learn from the diaries of Alice Comyns Carr, who was a theater costume designer married to a drama critic and a theater manager. In a rarely cited passage from her reminiscences, published in 1926, Carr recalled how decades earlier, James had entertained the daughters of Punch cartoonist George Du Maurier by attempting to replicate Bernhardt's famous glide through a doorway as Tosca at the end of Act 4 of Tosca, which was a play by Victorien Sardou written specifically for Bernhardt before it became an opera. And Bernhardt premiered the role of Tosca in London in 1888. Henry James had a very critical appreciation of dramatic impersonation, and he often amused the Du Maurier girls by his imitation of theatrical celebrities. He had just come from seeing Sarah Bernhardt in Tosca and undertook to give a, quote, representation of the great actress, end quote. But when he came to the point where he had to squeeze himself through a crack in the door, Henry James forgot that he was not so slim as the divine Sarah, and his plump figure stuck halfway. For years after, Carr adds, the girls would tease James by asking him to please be Sarah. Now, as this anecdote illustrates, imitation is not easy. James tries to slip into a star's skin, only to find himself flailing in a doorway. Much as he admired actors, in this instance, he could not translate his critical appreciation, Komen's Carr's phrase, of their work into an equally skilled performance of his own. The crack in the doorway that he fails to squeeze through is small, but the gap that it exposes between his dramatic talent and Bernhardt's is large. Nor did James himself consider imitation a heedless, involuntary reflex. In saying that he would give a representation of the great actress, James used a term that meant both an actor's interpretation of a role and an author's creation of a text. Representations frame the world, deciding what is worth including or excluding, and they thus imply an ambition to do more than simply copy reality. By offering to give his own representation of Bernhardt's famous glide through a doorway, James implied that his imitation would deploy all of his considerable artistic acumen. If his representation fell short, it was not for lack of intentional effort. And finally, imitation is not equally open to all. There's more than a hint of gay shaming in Carr's account of young women ridiculing an older man, famously known, if nothing else, for not being married, a confirmed bachelor, but I think that Komen's Carr would probably have brought a more sophisticated understanding of James's life and manner to their perception of this scene, and they seem quite eager to mock him for so enthusiastically trying to imitate a female celebrity and failing. As a novelist, James prided himself on his self-consciousness and keen observation, famously counseling novice writers to try to be someone on whom nothing is lost. How embarrassing, Carr implies, for the master to get caught in the act of forgetting the difference between his plump body and the divine Sarah's slim one. Try as he might, Henry could not be Sarah, although his botched imitation did achieve the highly theatrical goal of drawing attention to himself. James was no ordinary imitator, and his attempt to copy a celebrity failed in part because he ambitiously tried to reproduce an extraordinarily demanding piece of stage business. Most people who imitate celebrities content themselves with repeating catchphrases, buying products, or adopting looks associated with their favorite stars. Those ways of imitating celebrities existed well before the rise of radio, film, television, and YouTube. Until the late 18th century, images of celebrated leaders, artists, and performers tended to emphasize their resemblance to an abstract classical ideal. And it's also quite striking looking at 18th century images of famous actors like Sarah Siddons or David Garrick that one image doesn't really resemble the next. So there isn't the sense in a pre-photographic era of a type, of a personality type that you can readily imitate. But around the time of the French and American Revolutions, portraitists and printmakers began to focus on the quirky details that differentiated one individual from another, and that certainly differentiated them quite dramatically from a kind of Roman or Greek classical ideal. So images depicting Rousseau wearing an unusual kind of cap, or Byron with his shirt collar open, it doesn't look that open, but when you read people at the time writing about it, it's almost as though he weren't wearing a shirt at all, made it easier for ordinary men to imitate the small traits of great ones. And just to give you some comparative shirt openness, sorry, there's Wordsworth. Both of these images are from 1812. And I've actually found diary entries from the 1850s and 60s in which one woman says that she saw a picture of a friend's father, and he looked just like Byron with his long curly hair and his shirt collar open. So clearly men were able to imitate the Byronic look and have it be recognized even decades later as Byronic. During the 19th century, industrial modernity not only led to an explosion of imagery that culminated with the commercialization of photography in the 1860s, the first decade when most people could readily buy a photograph, usually a photograph of a celebrated person, in pretty much any urban center for not very much money. Industrial modernity also increased the sense that bodies could and should be transformed for the better through what historian Michael Anton Budd has called the drive to sculpt the physical self. In the 1840s and 1850s, the acolytes of Edwin Forrest, a U.S. actor renowned for his robust physique and rough manners, often copied his facial hair, mustaches, beards. A few decades later, a journalist reported that Sarah Bernhardt's, quote, smallest gestures were noted, copied, exaggerated by a multitude of idolatrous women. What were celebrity imitators trying to achieve? The mostly male, which is a question you have to ask once you set aside the assumption that they are heedlessly, automatically acting out of reflexes. Well, the mostly male authors who published their observations of Bernhardt's mostly female imitators saw those women as seeking to emulate Bernhardt's eccentricity, originality, defiance, and will, her signature traits as a celebrity personality, as well as the seductiveness and emotional intensity associated with her signature roles. Many who aspired to imitate the star contented themselves, and actually we can just go back to that. So this is Bernhardt actually in a role, the Dumas play L'Étrangère. Many who aspired to imitate the star contented themselves with purchasing products associated with her. Although the celebrity endorsement business has developed exponentially in the last several decades, the practice of using celebrities to advertise goods has existed for at least 200 years. Carriage manufacturers named Surreys after Sarah Bernhardt because she represented energy and speed, while an exhibitor of a Bernhardt pelargonium saw woman and flower as sharing a vivid, highly colored elegance. The stormy Edwin Forrest lent his name to fire engines and locomotives. The child star Clara Fisher had hers attached to mint juleps and babies. Many 19th century advertisers attached stars' names to goods without permission, but some paid celebrities to vouch for products that they claimed to use. Bernhardt, for example, provided testimonials for face powder, as we will see later, for wigs, for water, and for the Edison Record Company. In the 19th century, many copied how stars dressed on stage and in the studio photographs displayed for sale in shop windows on almost every city street. Like modern celebrity, modern fashion involved creating patterns, types, and models, and distributing them to ever-growing numbers of people over increasingly large distances and at an increasingly fast pace. Theater and fashion had especially close connections in the 19th and early 20th centuries. As theater historian Marlis Schweitzer has shown, many women went to the theater to observe and replicate the latest styles. Many department stores would do tie-ins with theater productions. Commenting in 1882 on the social influence of the typical Parisian actress, a journalist observed that, and not at all censoriously, just as a sociological observation, quote, "The most virtuous of women studies the actress, learns her by heart, copies her outfits, her posture, her manners, her eccentricities." This was, and he was talking about a generic actress in that case, and this was certainly the case with Sarah Bernhardt. When Bernhardt toured provincial France in 1880, the newspaper Le Figaro reported on how interested their female readers were in her costumes and described, somewhat outlandishly, how even in churches, young girls dream of Sarah Bernhardt's outfits between Bible verses. Bernhardt's sartorial influence extended to England, where one could buy a Bernhardt costume at a French dressmaker's in Covent Garden, and where British fashion magazines advertised Bernhardt gloves, bonnets, dresses, bodices, corsages, blouses, perfume, hairstyles, and hair dye. After the 1860s, when many middle-class women acquired their own sewing machines, the fashion press also began to include detailed patterns in every issue, which provided instructions on how to make outfits worn by female stars. One magazine advised a reader to copy the Sarah Bernhardt toilette in this journal, while another directed a reader writing in from South Africa on how to make a Sarah Bernhardt ruffle, depicted in a plate that had appeared in a previous issue. While journalists writing for the women's press focused on the intelligence that Bernhardt exercised when inventing new fashions, those writing for humor and sports publications with primarily male readerships focused on ridiculing the women who tried to imitate the star. Writing for readers who defined themselves against any markedly feminine pursuit, those reporters saw the women who copied Bernhardt dresses, bonnets, and hairstyles as the sartorial equivalents of Henry James stuck in a doorway. Their attempts to reproduce the star's distinctive look only showed up their failure to achieve it. An 1892 review by an avowedly, quote, captious critic of Bernhardt's Cleopatra in the Illustrated Sporting and Dramatic News, which whoever may have actually read it, as you read through it frequently, presents itself as addressing male readers only, noted that even in June, a month when most playhouses were deserted, quote, it is still the fashion, apparently, to have seen Bernhardt. And as in matters of fashion, the fair sex takes the lead. There has been quite a rush of ladies to Cleopatra. 9 out of 10 women whom we saw in the vestibule had evidently made up after the familiar portraits of the actress, especially in arrangement of the hair, end quote. So for this commentator, Bernhardt's glamour as the Queen of the Nile, famous for her powers of seduction, becomes tarnished when mirrored by her less appealing followers who transform the rare into the common. Some journalists mock celebrity imitation by imagining it taken to comic extremes. The cartoon showed here is from an 1883 issue of Funny Folks, which, again, from the way it addresses readers, tends to posit male authorship and male readership. And it shows a woman with gloves so long that they need to be held up by her maid. A man in top hat and monocle, standing in for the supercilious male reader, observes the scene. The caption reads, "The gloves worn by Sarah Bernhardt in Fedora were 4.5 feet long." Aristocratic lady amateur. "Well, Mr. Spangler, I may not be so good an actress as Sarah Bernhardt, but my gloves are 6 inches longer." She should run for president. The gloves caricatured here were indeed world famous. Even the Rocky Mountain News reported on them. The cartoon aims to deflate the actual Sarah Bernhardt gloves, literally and figuratively, by exaggerating them even further. The glove fabric that would have been tightly compacted on Bernhardt's arm appears here stretched and sagging to the point of formlessness. The cartoon parses imitation not as helpless mimicry, but as a form of risible, though deliberate, competition. Unable to improve on Bernhardt's acting, the aristocratic amateur boasts of exceeding the star's already excessive glove length. The cartoon's chief target is the vanity of the copycat, who boasts of outdoing Bernhardt but has failed even to equal her. But it also pokes deadpan fun at Bernhardt's extravagance in wearing gloves 4.5 feet long, suggesting that imitation belittles both the imitator and the model imitated. Women's fashion magazines encouraged readers to imitate how celebrities dressed and the traits their styles expressed. By contrast, men's magazines challenged both the idea that fashion might embody a celebrity's essence and the possibility that ordinary women might succeed at imitating stars. Monica Miller has shown that for several centuries, caricaturists have belittled African Americans who exercised agency by dressing up. 19th century male satirists similarly ridiculed women who expressed aspirations for independence and public attention by identifying with or imitating Bernhardt. An 1891 Russian burlesque, and Bernhardt traveled to Russia twice, so she was well known in theater circles there. And this burlesque entitled Sarah Bernhardt or Loge Number 2 in the Dress Circle spoofed a variety of women attempting to imitate the international celebrity known for her eccentric personality. When a husband in the play forbids his wife from going out to see the actress, she retorts, a la Bernhardt, "I'll do whatever I want." One character takes up painting after discovering that, quote, "Sarah Bernhardt's artistic temperament is like mine." Others imagine that, like Bernhardt, they will become the focus of public attention. "During the intermission, they won't be able to take their binoculars off me," says one woman. "Me neither," echoes another, who later in the play walks on stage, moving dramatically to ask the audience, "Don't you think I look remarkably like Sarah Bernhardt?" Not only is the answer no, the very question exposes how little her self-knowledge matches her self-regard. Satires like these posited both imitation and imitability as a privilege denied to the majority of women. From one vantage point, such caricatures seem designed, like most humor, to correct unseemly self-regard and excessive accumulations of status. From another, however, they seem intent on mocking anyone who dares to rise above her appointed station. As commoners who had risen in the ranks, celebrities became ideals for those aspiring upward and targets for those who wanted to limit social mobility. Though the group that most parodists poked fun at for getting above themselves by imitating Bernhardt was white women, a small but significant number presented celebrity imitation as a racial privilege confined to white people. In a catch-22 typical of racism's double binds, cartoonists depicted members of non-white groups as abject, whether they succeeded in imitating white celebrities or failed. So consider this 1881 advertisement for La Diaphane, a rice powder endorsed by Sarah Bernhardt. So designed to take up an entire page, this busy image consists of four corner panels that from top left to bottom right purport to tell the story of Bernhardt's departure from France, that's at top left, her arrival in New York's harbor, top right, the dispersal of her name throughout Europe, bottom left, and her popularity in even the remotest areas of America, bottom right. The image associates the celebrity with a product advertised in two metonymic ways. It suggests that the powder has actually touched the star's skin, and it offers in the center, sort of bottom, well, not the bottom center, it offers a facsimile of Bernhardt's practically illegible handwriting. It's actually quite brilliant. This really is her handwriting. I've seen letters of her. Someone would write to her and say, can I come see you tomorrow at 4? And she would just send some scrawl back. And they would be like, okay, I don't know if she said yes or no. So it's a very good strategy. So since we cannot actually read this testimonial to the powder's wonders, its main purpose is to make us feel closer to the star's body by offering an image of writing produced by her own hand. The ad also presents the celebrity and the good for sale as metaphors for each other. La Diaphane, the name of the powder, refers both to the product and to Bernhardt herself, the diaphanous one. Both are delicate and filmy. Both move quickly. The caption to the panel at the bottom left explains that Bernhardt's fame moved through Europe like a train of powder, making a pun on gunpowder and face powder. Both maintain their freshness even when traveling around the world. Both are aesthetic, aristocratic, and grand, as signified by the various emblems with which the image is overloaded, including the circular medallion at the bottom of the frame of Bernhardt at the center there, which contains the quasi-noble motto that Bernhardt devised for herself, quand même, despite everything. Perhaps most importantly, but also most ambiguously, both the powder and the performer are white. Celebrity endorsements typically invite identification and imitation. Thousands of ads like this one have suggested that by purchasing products associated with stars, consumers can become more like them. It is therefore striking that two of the vignettes in this ad block the imitative impulse. At top left, the image of a grotesquely magnified Bernhardt with an equally huge powder box invites the viewer to perceive the reputation of the product's celebrity endorser as unjustifiably inflated. So her body is much bigger than the ship, and her head is much bigger than her body, and that powder box is really large. But despite this gesture towards exotic allure, the image and the caption both find ways to establish the black figure's subordinate position in a racial hierarchy. So the exoticism, though it's there, is certainly not redeeming the representation of these characters as outside the limits of what this celebrity product might be able to achieve. By presenting the black figure as wanting to correct her, quote, poorly whitened skin, the caption presents whiteness as both norm and ideal. By depicting one of the women in a gracelessly contorted pose that may be meant to suggest a poor attempt at imitating one of Bernhardt's famous onstage gestures, the image associates blackness with the savage and grotesque. Minstrel shows often did the same when claiming to imitate black movement and speech, and the contorted posture of the woman on the left in the image from the advertisement closely resembles images of actor T.D. Rice, shown here in the slide on the left, performing in blackface the famous Jump Jim Crow dance. By presenting the two black female figures in dresses whose short sleeves and skirts expose their arms, ankles, and feet, the image associates them with an abject poverty, impossibly distant from the delicate, filmy beauty associated with the advertised rice powder. Compare their faces, poses, and garb to the idealized renderings of genteel white women at the bottom left of this ad and also at the top right, whose elaborately tailored dresses have high necks and long skirts, and who appear surrounded by elements of modern urban infrastructure, such as sandwich boards and streetlights. The fashionable white women occupy the same space as Bernhardt. At top right, they're shown waiting to see her disembark at bottom left, they read an ad for one of her public appearances. By contrast, the black women appear in an isolated tropical setting, far from the realms of fashionable urbanity. Their exposed dark forearms reverse the long white gloves that Bernhardt wears in the ad's central images, though those are not the gloves that were referred to in the earlier cartoon. These are shorter gloves. They know Bernhardt only through the powder named after her, making the links between the celebrity and these imitators as flimsy as the powder's ability to whiten their dark skins. The bizarre self-contradiction of this advertisement replicates a tension within celebrity and consumer culture between egalitarianism, anyone can be a star or at least powder up like one, and exclusion. Some people can never rise above their appointed stations. The vignettes at top left and bottom right defy a fundamental principle of advertising, which is to claim miraculous powers for their products and their endorsers. The top image, the one at top left, that presents a grotesque Bernhardt, undercuts the celebrity's grandeur by inflating it beyond credibility, while the bottom right image mocks a consumer for believing that the advertised product might work. Tellingly, both vignettes also spoof the product itself by exaggerating the size of the round powder box that looms large in both top left and bottom right corners, anchoring the entire composition. Advertising touts glamour, but it also risks cheapening it by expanding its purview to anyone who can afford to buy a box of rice powder. Celebrity elevates stars by making them known to multitudes, but by definition, those multitudes will include society's least prestigious groups. The black women who inflate Bernhardt here are also shown as debasing her, and caricature seeks to put both imitator and imitated in their proper places. Taken as a whole, the advertisement for La Diafan seems designed not only to sell a commodity, but also to assure the middle-class white women consumers that it targets as its chosen addressees that celebrity status and imitation will not go so far as to overcome hierarchies of class and caste. The sardonic image of the oversized Bernhardt implies that no matter how glamorous and successful she has become, she would never, as an illegitimate unmarried woman who worked for a living, possess the ease, grace, and respect enjoyed by women of leisure firmly attached to husbands and fathers, the women represented at the other corners. The image of the black women, too dark to be lightened by La Diafan, similarly conveys that while everybody wants to use the advertised good, not everybody can. And of course, that refusal of the power of the powder to extend to everyone who would buy it is all the more important because when everyone wants to do something, excluding some people takes on even more meaning. The attempt to imitate celebrities may be universal, but only those at the top of the racial hierarchy are allowed to be seen as successfully copying the stars. Celebrity and commodity culture work by appealing to large numbers of people who hunger for status and distinction. One common critique is that both do so in ways that foster illusions about capitalism fostering equality for all. This advertisement, however, makes no effort to reconcile that contradiction between elitism and populism. Instead, it blatantly seeks to limit celebrity culture's leveling energies. Another set of images from the 1880s, these from the United States, similarly mock low-status ethnic groups who seek to elevate themselves by imitating a celebrity. The first presents a series of ethnic Oscar Wildes. These images depend on a coarse racism that exaggerates features considered typical of each of the respective groups pictured. I'm actually not going to go in order, but I'll point things out to you. The Jewish Oscar Wilde, who's at top right, has the long nose and high cheekbones, also visible in 19th century caricatures of Sarah Bernhardt and Benjamin Disraeli, or in George Cruikshank's illustrations of Fagin and Oliver Twist, or George Du Maurier's depictions of Svengali and Trilby. The African-American Oscar at bottom left has spiky hair, exaggeratedly full lips, and like the women in the rice powder ad, exposed legs and bare feet. The German Oscar at top center wears lederhosen and drinks beer from a stein that doubles as a vase for a lily, one of the flowers associated with Oscar Wilde. The Asian-American Oscar at bottom right has sallow skin, a pigtail, and a long mustache. The Irish Oscar at top left highlights how celebrity offers a path to upward mobility, however limited, that caricaturists seek to block entirely. Wilde was himself Irish, but the coarse features and fancy dress of the Irish Wilde are intended to show up the real Oscar's pretension in trying to rise above his national station, and to demonstrate the impossibility of masses of Irishmen following suit. The humor here, such as it is, depends on mingling the rarefied with the base, the lily and the sunflower with a pig, a mug, and a jar labeled for sale. We are asked to laugh at the distance between the celebrity and the abject ethnic groups who strive and fail to imitate him. Imitation only widens the gulf between Wilde's effete interest in beautifying everyday life, and this cartoon was made at a time when Wilde was touring the United States in 1881 and 1882, lecturing on aestheticism and the house beautiful. So we're meant to see the distance between his aestheticism and the Jew's venal commercialism, his fancy dress and the ragged state of the barefoot and pantless African-American, his aestheticism and the Asian's utterly foreign garb, decor, and music. For this cartoonist, a Jew or Irishman who tries to mimic Wilde's aestheticism succeeds only in accentuating his distance from it, his ugliness, his ordinariness. Even as these images play on the gap between white Wilde and his ethnic others, they also lower Wilde to his imitator's level. The cartoon's point is not simply that a Jewish or black Wilde would be ridiculous, but that Wilde is himself ridiculous, with his long hair, extravagant costumes, and interest in home decor. Cartoonists also leveled their ridicule at the possibility that imitating Wilde might be a way for ethnic and racial groups to claim a visibility at odds with the desire of dominant classes to keep them out of sight, quietly serving others for little or no pay. And of course, all of the groups depicted here were either building railroads or were servants at the time in the 1880s. That would have been the main stereotype of what people belonging to these ethnic groups were doing. While journalists and cartoonists use ridicule to discourage ordinary women from imitating female stars, and even advertisers set racial limits on who could emulate white celebrities, white 19th century audiences applauded and rewarded white men who imitated women and African Americans. Minstrel acts, popular around the world well into the 1920s, featured white performers in blackface makeup who pretended to dance, sing, speak, and dress like cartoonish distortions of black people. Scholar Eric Lott has called minstrelsy an affair of copies and originals, and noted the affinities between cartoonists and minstrel performers, both of whom exaggerated easily recognized traits and types. In some cases, minstrels were white people claiming to imitate black people imitating white people. The recurring character Zip Coon, for example, represented a black dandy whose pretensions to gentility inevitably ended in malapropism and mayhem. Many minstrel troupes also parodied high art performers, such as opera singer Jenny Lind, tragedian Tommaso Salvini, and Sarah Bernhardt, who became the subject of several minstrel performances after her first tour of the United States in 1881. Now, minstrel performers tended to do two kinds of female impersonation. In the first kind, slender, young, handsome white men would don elegant fashions in order to impersonate white female celebrities or coquettish, light-skinned African-American beauties with haughty and delicate manners. So, for example, the Only Leon, that was his stage name, who impersonated Sarah Bernhardt throughout his career, did not always use blackface makeup in his refined depictions of elegant women in fancy dress. And during the period when Oscar Wilde lectured across the United States, Leon also performed as Miss Patient Wilde, a lover of, you guessed it, sunflowers and lilies, whose first name evoked the Gilbert and Sullivan operetta Patience, which itself included a character based on Wilde. But in the second, more buffoonish type of what was known as a wench act in minstrel shows, a white man blacked up and put on a coarse dress and headwear to impersonate a large and ungainly African-American woman whose dimensions and demeanor made any conventionally feminine behavior on her part seem absurd, particularly in the many skits that depicted such women, quote, awkwardly aping their betters. The Bernhardt minstrel acts popular in the early 1880s favored the second type of impersonation, so the grotesque, have a big guy kind of turn everything around, not the Only Leon, basically high-level drag incorporated into minstrel acts. So these 1880s minstrel burlesques transformed Sarah Bernhardt into Sarah Hartburn and Sarah Barnyard. Those were the two plays that got produced all around the world. And what they targeted was her signature role as Camille, which they turned into the low farce of Camille, C-A-L-M-E-E-L. So Camille was known in the Anglophone world as Camille or the Fate of a Coquette. The minstrel act was Camille or the Fate of a Croquette. As this wordy ad, and I'll tell you all the parts of it that you can't see very well but that are, you know, interesting, explains, Sarah Barnyard transforms the flighty coquette who sacrifices all for love and dies of consumption on stage into a croquette, a heavy piece of fried dough, quote, solid enough to depend on. Advertisements for a different parody entitled Sarah Hartburn plugged the fashionable accessories coveted by Bernhardt fans. The promotion campaign when the act first opened in Philadelphia included a wagon that drove around town filled with trunks and boxes labeled Hartburns, laces, gloves, etc. Minstrel spoofs of Bernhardt became international hits, frequently performed throughout the United States and in London throughout the 1880s. One Ohio newspaper described an 1887 performance of William Henry Rice's original creation of Sarah Hartburn, that's his words, original creation, as popular enough to have the theater turning people away at the door. And while that might have been exaggerated, the play remained in Rice's repertory for close to 30 years, so it was clearly a reliable way to fill seats. By 1896, Camille had morphed into Clamille. By 1911, Sarah Barnyard and Sarah Hartburn had merged, and the act's subtitle had evolved into The Fate of a Chicken Croquette. Minstrel troupes often timed their performances of these parodies to coincide with actual Bernhardt performances in the same cities. In June 1881, for example, Rice performed Sarah Hartburn in London's St. James Hall, at the same time that Bernhardt performed Camille in French at London's Gaiety Theatre. So a painstaking newspaper review of Sarah Hartburn ascribed its appeal to popular interest in comparing pseudo-black copies with white originals. Quote, numbers have seen the great white Sarah, as the Americans call her, and nothing could be more natural than to compare the great black Sarah with the original. Somewhat humorlessly, the critic underscored the difference between the two versions, as though they were not supposed to be different. We are sorry we cannot pay Mr. Rice the compliment of calling his sketch a caricature of Mademoiselle Bernhardt. Save in a few peculiarities of manner, it is curiously unlike the original. So rather than a genuine imitation of Bernhardt, the reviewer wrote, the minstrel was, quote, it's a long quote, merely a grotesque artiste. A performer who stumbles about in a very awkward fashion and falls over his long skirts, which the original artiste manages with such cleverness. And I'm reading this at length so that you can get a feel for what the performance was like. Theater goers hear a performer shout in a husky voice and mix up references to the topical absurdities of the day when it is to her exquisite elocution and silvery tones that Mademoiselle Bernhardt owes so much of her fascinating power. They see the burlesque representative drinking water out of a pail and telling the attendant who brings a chair to sling it around the other way. They observe the mock Camille presenting her lover with a lettuce as the token of her affection and receiving in return a bottle of Zoidone, which was a common quack tonic of the time. They watch the imitator of Mademoiselle Bernhardt smear off a burnt cork. The burnt cork, that was the material used for blackface, in order to present a ghastly face, half black and half white, for the grotesque death scene. The journalist's indignation, though gallant, suggests a lack of familiarity with the conventions of minstrelsy, whose very point was to give white men a platform for highlighting that blacks were and always would be the opposite of whites. As another reviewer put it, Sarah Hartburn gives audiences, quote, a sort of Sarah Bernhardt reversed or turned topsy-turvy, an allusion to the character of Topsy, a young female slave in Uncle Tom's Cabin, whose representation in stage adaptations of Harriet Beecher Stowe's novel exemplified, as Robin Bernstein has shown, the racist belief that black children were impervious to pain. Topsy here becomes shorthand for both a reductive idea of blackness and for the antithesis of glamorous celebrity whiteness. Where the white Bernhardt was graceful, the black Bernhardt, the blackface Bernhardt, is clumsy. where the white Bernhardt received flowers, the black-faced Bernhardt gives lettuces. The white Bernhardt poetically recited, the black-faced Bernhardt huskily shouts. Bernhardt was famously known for gracefully twirling and falling backwards in Camille's death scene. Rice instead executed that moment by diving headfirst into a sofa. Everything about this performance presumes and reinforces the gulf between prestigious whiteness and lowly blackness, including its gambit that the performer's status as a white man, revealed at the very end when he smears off half of his blackface makeup, can survive his impersonation of a black woman. So to conclude, celebrities make themselves available for imitation by presenting themselves as distinctive types whose images and stories can be easily multiplied. The proliferation of consumer goods associated with celebrities might seem only to confirm the longstanding theory that stars are themselves commodities, objects to be bought and sold. But while copying often seems like a submissive action or reflex that only confirms the imitator's secondary status and the triviality of the imitated, many 19th century satirists understood celebrity imitation as a privilege reserved for the higher orders, where the satirists implicitly placed themselves, since parody is itself a form of imitation. A comic Russian play burlesque grandiose elite women inspired by Bernhardt to rebel against the husbands they are supposed to venerate and obey. Advertisers, cartoonists, and minstrel performers depicted African Americans and other low-status ethnic groups, mimicking Bernhardt and Wilde, as trying and failing to exceed the limits placed on them. Fashion magazines presented imitation as enhancing both imitator and imitated, while caricatures often demeaned both, even as they emphasized the gap between celebrity models and copycat fans. But perhaps the clearest sign that imitating celebrities can benefit and bolster the imitators was how eager so many white men were to restrict the pleasures of celebrity imitation to themselves. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You just heard a lecture by Sharon Marcus, Associate Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. Professor Marcus's lecture was titled The Drama of Celebrity, and was presented by the Boston University Department of English, the Center for the Study of Europe, the American and New England Studies Program, the Women's, Gender, and Sexuality Studies Program, and the Department of World Languages and Literatures. Our moderator was Boston University Associate Professor of English, Joseph Resick. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Matthew Lissette. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.